A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights are probably gone.
So had the stairs.
You are just number six.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 51. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about Neverwhere. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
Richard Mayhew has lived in London for a while. He's originally from Scotland, and he says that he doesn't get lost in the London Underground, the subway system, anymore. Well, maybe he does still get lost in the subway system.
And as you say, that's the basic setup and concept of Neverwhere. Quite how Richard comes to get lost in the underground. And Neverwhere was a BBC Two fantasy series from 1996. It went out in six episodes, each about 30 minutes long. And it's the fantasy type genre. We're straying slightly from typical science fiction, but there's a lot of good fun features here. And it was created by two very interesting people, by a writer called Neil Gaiman, who we'll talk about in some detail, and by the British comedian Lenny Henry. So there's lots of interesting stuff in the background of Neverwhere, which we'll get to.
What an interesting combination that is. Neil Gaiman and Lenny Henry are not two people that I would expect to be working together, knowing their work separately.
No, that's right. I mean, they are unusual, but they are, I think, they're very good friends, and they'd been, I think, looking to work together on something when this idea came up.
Right. So the ideas behind this are in many ways about homelessness, and they set up this mysterious fantasy world that is in London and around and below London and has very strong fantasy ideas to it and is this otherworldly kind of place while still in many ways being in the London that we know. And place names and names of different places in London become very prominent, and we get a classic sort of hero quest in this. So if you're thinking about quest stories like Lord of the Rings or even The Wizard of Oz, there are definitely parallels there.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, as you say, particularly the Wizard of Oz type theme will come up throughout Neverwhere. And as well as being a TV series, it also went on to have some success in other incarnations. It's been a book in a couple of different versions, which we'll talk about. There's been a comic book version of Neverwhere, and there's long been talk about a film version, which we'll perhaps get to discuss in our second episode.
So as Neverwhere starts, we are introduced to our protagonist, Richard Mayhew, and his fiancée we're introduced to very soon after. We see Richard as this sort of starting young business person, and his fiancée is very much a social climber, and she is into advancing her position in her job very much, and so on and so forth. And the two of them, very early in it, are on their way to a dinner with her boss and maybe some of her other colleagues, and she is being very clear about how he has to behave in order to impress her boss. Along the way, Richard stops to help someone. When he sees an injured woman in pain, he stops to help.
That's right. They sort of, as you say, they're yuppies in a way. They're London yuppies on their way to an important dinner, and they literally stumble across this young woman lying in the road injured. And their responses are quite different. I mean, the girlfriend, Jessica, is keen to get on to this important dinner with her boss, but Richard stops to help and finds this strange woman, this strange young woman who needs his help.
That's right. They gave you the contrast right there that Richard was the sympathetic one and Jessica was certainly not. And of course, as it goes ahead, the woman that they found injured and struggling is in fact the daughter of this noble family in the underground world that we soon find out is called London Below. and we find out that she is sort of this noble, highborn damsel in distress that he is rescuing. And those ideas are very much sown at this point in the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're off on the hero quest already. He stopped to help. He then gets dragged into the mystery of who killed her family and who's still trying to kill her. And by helping her, it also has a considerable impact on his life. He sort of... he loses touch, or he becomes separated from what they call London above. And in a sort of bizarre twist, really, the city of London seems to forget he ever existed. And by having contact with London below, all the people he knew just seem to ignore him and don't acknowledge his existence, which is very strange and weird.
Yes, we learn very quickly that London above and London below are two separate things, and you have to choose. You cannot be a part of both of them. You have to either be above or below. And it also starts to bring in that metaphor about the homeless people, in that the people from London below are not entirely invisible to the above people, but the above people always ignore and quickly forget the below people. So there is some metaphor there that we're introduced to pretty early and runs the length of the show.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the most interesting things, in a way, about this whole concept of Neverwhere. It's this idea of the homeless people that London just sort of ignores, or, as you say, if they do see them, they could soon forget about them and they have no impact on them. It's a fascinating theme right the way through the series.
Yes, for sure. Now, getting into the cast of characters here, we have already mentioned Richard, played by Gary Bakewell, and he's, like we said, a young city office worker who is Scottish, new to London, sort of settling into life in London and his job, and we get the idea that he isn't really satisfied with either of those things. That he's okay with this, but he's not entirely satisfied. And that's sort of where he starts out on this journey as a character. And we're also very, very soon introduced to Dor, played by Laura Fraser. And she is the young injured woman that Richard helps at the beginning of the story. She is the last of the Portico family and has the ability of opening. So the name Dor is more than just a coincidence. She can open doors or make doors appear where there are none, you know, pass through solid walls in certain cases, open locked doors, and so on. And she is determined to avenge her murdered family members, which is basically all of her family now, and also to find out what's going on and what happened with her family. So that is sort of her quest, and that's very much a part of it.
Yeah. And as you say, her ability of opening things is also an important part of the whole story and will come in useful at several points in the plot. And then we have the villains of the piece, Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandermeer. Fantastic characters. Mr. Croup was played by Huel Bennett, who we actually discussed last time because he was in Artemis 81, where he was struggling with some difficult material. And I think it's fair to say, Brian, that he's having much more fun in Neverwhere as Mr. Croup.
Oh, absolutely.
Playing the character with a certain villainous relish throughout. And he's accompanied by his sort of assistant, who's referred to as his brother, Mr. Vandermeer, who's a tall, imposing character, played by the actor Clive Russell. And again, having extreme fun with the role. Mr. Croup is fond of elaborate speech, and Mr. Vandermeer is fond of elaborate violence, basically. Whenever they're on screen, after their first memorable appearance, clutching lights and wearing these weird plastic overcoats, basically whenever they turn up, it's great fun and they're very watchable, I think.
They are the henchmen villains of the piece. We don't know for much of the story exactly who they're working for. We're not sure who they're working for, but they are like a classic pair of henchmen villains. They remind me in some ways of the various James Bond henchmen villains we've had over the years, although these guys are a little darker and a little more bizarre even than the Bond ones.
Yeah, they're fantastic characters.
Yes, they really are.
And while we're speaking of fantastic characters, we have to go on to discuss the Marquis de Carabas, who is a very strange character and very extravagant, a sort of wheeler dealer in promises who can get things done. And he's sort of employed and recruited to Dor's cause, so to help the Lady Dor find out what happened to her family and avenge them. And the Marquis de Carabas was played with sort of theatrical and pantomime almost flair by another favourite of us here on British Invaders, who we've talked about before, Patterson Joseph. And he, again, had a great time, I think, playing the Marquis.
Yes, the Marquis was played with tremendous flair. He was a very outlandish character who is always doing things in return for someone owing him a favor. And he is clearly not someone who is a nice or pleasant person, but someone who gets things done and is generally quite acerbic and self-centered. Also very enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I mean, whenever he's on screen, whenever Sir Patterson Joseph turns up, it's fantastic fun. And his costume's great. And his hair, he's got this rather elaborate hairstyle, which is fantastic. Really good fun.
And then we get to the Angel Islington, played by Peter Capaldi. And we have a real angel. The Angel Islington is a tube station, a subway station. We'll talk about those more in a little bit. But in this case, there is an actual angel there living in London Below. And there is a big part of the quest in order to get to the Angel Islington. And there are all these elements about what will the angel do, and at the different times that we meet the angel, what does he do and what are his motivations? So he's a sort of mysterious character. Peter Capaldi, who played the Angel Islington, was seen quite recently in British sci-fi. He played Frobisher in the Torchwood Season 3 miniseries, Children of Earth, which, as we record this, aired quite recently.
Yes, and he's very good in that, and he's very good here in Neverwhere as this ethereal angel who, when we see him, they did some neat tricks with the lighting and the costuming and the camera work so that his character seems to glow on screen. And I believe they shot him with some sort of reflective material in his costume so that his light sort of seems to bounce off him, and he looks fantastic.
Good evening. I am the Marquis de Carabas. I've agreed to help a young lady called Dor find out who killed her family. I've obtained a bodyguard for her and am looking after her as if she were the most important thing under the world, which she may in fact be. Unfortunately, she has insisted on bringing along a stray from London above over my protests.
Then we've got, amidst this cast of colourful characters, we've also got the character of London Below itself, which, as we've said, is this fantasy world that beneath the streets of London, although sometimes it even takes us to the rooftops of London. And, you know, we meet it right in the first episode, that it's very strange down there. It's filled with all sorts of weird and wonderful characters. There are the rat speakers, who are humans who live just to sort of translate the wishes of rats to the rest of the community. There's the vampiric velvets, who sort of stalk around in long gothic robes and look mysterious and sinister. There's the sewer folk. There's floating markets. There's loads of stuff, almost too many ideas to discuss, really. I mean, there's just fantastic imagination in Neverwhere, and the stuff all comes thick and fast, which is great fun.
Yes, we get all kinds of things there, and we get the idea of there being some kind of feudal society as well, and various sort of fantastic ideas and powers that people have, like the rat speaking and door opening and so on, and all sorts of little unusual things that happen there. We also get into the idea of names and the interpretation of names of places in London, particularly from the London Underground. You end up with a lot of place names, most of which are underground station names. So we get the Old Bailey, we get Knightsbridge, we get Blackfriars, Earl's Court, and so on. And all of these are interpreted in these sort of more literal ways, or many of them are. So you get Earl's Court being the court of an earl who lives there. And we had mentioned the Angel Islington is an actual angel, and Knightsbridge with a K becomes Knightsbridge without a K, and it's a bridge where it's always dark, it's always nighttime as you cross the bridge. And, you know, actual friars in Blackfriars and so on. And they even mention shepherds at Shepherd's Bush. You know, there are lots of these in there. And you get this idea that there's this very ancient sort of medieval fantasy type world that is beneath the surface that we can't see, but the names of things that we use come from this other world that we can't see.
It's perhaps the single best idea in the whole series of Neverwhere, is this marvelous idea that all the names actually mean something. And as you say, that the names we use have derived from real characters or real people in London Below. And Neil Gaiman, the author, has a lot of fun with it. And it just seems to fit the whole story so well. And as you say, Brian, the sort of community of London Below seems to be split into a sort of feudal society with different fiefdoms or different domains. And it's hinted at that there is a state of uneasy truce between them. And there are certain areas where, particularly I think the floating market, where there is no conflict and there's always a truce at the floating market. And there were hints of a subplot about trying to unite the different kingdoms of London Below as part of one of the underlying ideas driving the story in Neverwhere, although it doesn't really get played out. It just gets mentioned a few times. But there's also hints that London is not the only great city to have its mysterious underworld, fantasy world. Again, there's a couple of mentions of other cities around the world having similar fantasy lands beneath them and similar fantasy creatures there as well.
That's right. And we get this feeling that while we know there is a truce in the floating markets, that there is not an out-and-out war in London Below, but there is this idea that there's lots of minor conflict. You know, it's not completely peaceful either. There are lots of different groups that have different motivations and do different things. There isn't a real rule of law in a lot of it, it seems.
Yeah.
Now, Richard learns quite early, and we mentioned this a bit earlier, that as soon as he starts having contact with people from London Below, that he really can't go back to London Above. So he finds that once he sees and notices Dor, which we don't really know why he did, but they mention this idea that for some reason he noticed Dor when she was injured and right there in his path. And once he did that and started to help her, it started a chain of events where he started interacting with people. And once that was happening, he was just gone from London Above. And his job was gone. His fiancée, Jessica, didn't know him. And you get this idea that they're really two different places, that you can't be part of both. As Dor and the Marquis de Carabas set off to find Islington, the Angel Islington, they look to find a bodyguard to help with this. And this will, in part, relieve the Marquis so he can go and do other related things, which he does for part of the story. And they recruit this woman Hunter, played by Tanya Moody, as a bodyguard. And you get the idea of the hunters and the warriors of London Below as well. So this is a part of things as well. And Hunter makes reference to some things that have happened in the other underground cities below, I think it was Moscow and New York and so on.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I think that's where the mention of the other cities comes in, from Hunter. The places that she's been and the mythical creatures that she's battled there. And while all this is going on, Richard, who's now cast adrift from London Above, finds he has to basically join this group of Dor and de Carabas and Hunter and journey with them. And he's very much hoping that he's going to get his original life back. He's going to get back into London Above. And that's, I think, where we get one of the ideas that the Angel Islington is almost like the Wizard of Oz, that if he can get to the Angel Islington with Dor and de Carabas, he may get his life back.
So Richard Mayhew becomes Dorothy wanting to go home.
Absolutely, yes. He's got ruby slippers and everything. But also, while this is happening, there's, again, just a very small moment that played out, I thought, quite well indeed. There's a very brief suggestion, which is part of the plot, that actually what may be happening is that Richard Mayhew himself may have lost his mind and become an actual homeless person on the streets of London, and that maybe the story and the land of Neverwhere, of London Below, is all his fantasy. It's touched on briefly. It's a sort of plot point. I thought it was quite an interesting idea and an effective little moment in the series.
Yes, it was actually quite a powerful moment because it was played quite well. It was pretty dramatic.
Yeah, it was well done. You know, Gary Bakewell as Richard, I think, doesn't get the big dramatic stuff like Croup and Vandemar and the Marquis de Carabas, but when he has his moment of madness, he takes that part very well, and as you say, it is quite moving and powerful. So that was very good. We should move on, I think, to talk about the creators and some of the production of Neverwhere.
Yes, well, of course, the main person we have to mention is Neil Gaiman, who is a British writer. He was born in 1960. He's now living in the US, and he is still actively writing a variety of things. Where he first became well known to a lot of us was in the 1980s when he wrote Don't Panic, The Guide to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So he was writing about Douglas Adams and his books at that point.
Yeah, that's right. And then he moved into writing for comics, and he was inspired by the great British comic book writer Alan Moore, who was a friend of his and who helped get him some of his first comic writing jobs with the British magazine 2000 AD. And then he moved to America and to write the series Sandman for DC Comics, which is now an absolute classic amongst comic book fans. The long-running series Sandman, I think, won just about every sort of science fiction and fantasy book award that was going, which was quite unusual for a comic series.
That's quite an extensive long series, isn't it?
I think it ran to about 75 issues, so it ran for about 6 years or so. And if you've ever read it, you'll know it's an absolute fantastic read. It's now all collected in graphic novels, or you can buy it in large absolute editions, and it's just a marvelous piece of literature about the King of Dreams and about his domain and how he loses it and has to regain his throne, and then what happens to him after that. Marvelous stuff. He also went on to write another very important series called Miracle Man, which had first been revived by Alan Moore and has recently been the subject of some quite important news that it may have been taken over by Marvel Comics. But Neil Gaiman is also very famous now for writing novels, because after his comic books, he moved into writing novels. And I think the most notable ones are American Gods, which has the fantastic idea that all the former gods that were worshipped and who are now not so popular have gone to live in America and trying to just live ordinary lives. And that's a great, fun read. But he also wrote Coraline, a children's book, which has recently been adapted into a 3D animation. Stardust, again, which was filmed a few years ago. And his most recent book, a sort of new approach to the Jungle Book, set in a graveyard where a child is raised by the ghosts in a graveyard, and that's called The Graveyard Book, which is another fantastic read. So he's done lots of great work. If you've not read Neil Gaiman, it's really worth trying to get into some of his books because they are fantastic stuff.
There have been several film adaptations of his as well. You mentioned Stardust, but there was also Mirror Mask.
That's right. He worked on the film Mirror Mask with his great friend and collaborator, the graphic artist Dave McKean, who we'll mention in a moment, because he produced the credits and a lot of the design for Neverwhere. But yes, that's another very interesting fantasy film, Mirror Mask.
Yes, he's done a lot of fantasy, hasn't he? I understand his first novel was actually a collaboration with Terry Pratchett, so even from that point he was into fantasy things of that type.
It wasn't a Discworld novel, but it was a fantasy novel with Terry Pratchett called Good Omens, which again is a very enjoyable read. So he's worked with a lot of sort of fairly well-known people like Terry Pratchett and Alan Moore, and as we've said, he's great friends with Lenny Henry, the British comedian. Lenny Henry, I think, had been wanting to work with Neil Gaiman on something, and so he collaborated with him to come up with some of the ideas for Neverwhere.
Up there, through that door.
It's sealed off. We'd need special tools.
Richard, my family, we're openers. It's our talent.
You were going to London above?
Yeah, British Museum.
I am your bodyguard in London below. I cannot go with you to London above.
Hunter, you're my bodyguard.
I must stay in London below.
But you have to.
My lady, I cannot.
Right. Come on, Richard.
Look, why don't we all stay down here together? And then we can find the marquee and we can all go together.
I didn't know before looking at Neverwhere that Neil Gaiman and Lenny Henry had been friends. It is not a combination that I would have expected because I'm used to Lenny Henry's work as a stand-up comic and a sketch comedy comedian. So it was interesting to see the two of them come together and do this work together. And in fact, what they were talking about initially, Lenny Henry had this idea of doing something about London's homeless people. And this was sort of the idea that started things off was, what about writing a drama about London's homeless people? And Neil Gaiman had some reservations about that because he didn't want to glorify homelessness and make people want to aspire to it and so on and so forth. So it was from there that it evolved into this idea of a fantasy that was sort of like London's homeless people, but definitely had fantasy elements where you had people with the powers of door opening and speaking to rats and a variety of other things that people could do or objects that had power to them. So it became clear that this was a fantasy world. Those discussions between Lenny Henry and Neil Gaiman led to the idea of the world of Neverwhere and London Above and London Below, and evolved into this TV serial, which was produced by Lenny Henry's company, Crucial Films.
So, you know, clearly their discussions led to something very interesting. And as you say, the Crucial Films company produced it. They handed it to a chap called Dewey Humphreys, a fairly well-known TV director, who'd worked on The Vicar of Dibley with Lenny Henry's wife, Dawn French, and he'd also worked on Absolutely Fabulous. So a fairly well-established director who did a pretty good job with Neverwhere, with the usual BBC budget restrictions throughout, but they managed to make it look very effective. And then we've also got another collaborator and friend of Neil Gaiman's. We've got the musician Brian Eno, who composed the music for Neverwhere. And again, we get this lovely sort of haunting, slightly unusual ambient music for the theme and throughout the episodes, which I don't know what you think, Brian, but I personally enjoyed that quite a bit. And certainly a bit of a contrast to the slightly more bleak music we had during Artemis 81.
Yes, the music in Neverwhere really does work quite well.
And it sort of seems to fit with this weird fantasy world, as do the, as I said, the fabulous opening credits by Dave McKean, who, you know, as we said, he worked on Mirror Mask. I think he directed Mirror Mask, but he's also worked, he produced all the covers for the Sandman comic series, and he's done the illustrations for, I think, most of Neil Gaiman's books, in particular his children's books Coraline and The Graveyard Book. So we get these wonderful visuals in the credits. We get this wonderful music from Brian Eno. We have these great ideas from Neil Gaiman and Lenny Henry.
There was a bit of a feeling here of Neil Gaiman doing something for television and calling on all his connections and friends to participate in this and bring their own styles and their own influence to it, with people like Dave McKean and Brian Eno. And I think that really worked well.
It did. It's fantastic. I mean, in a way, he's, you know, Neil Gaiman is the Marquis de Carabas. I think he called in all these favors that people owed him to get these quite well-established people like Brian Eno to come and work on Neverwhere.
That's right. Now, Neverwhere was shot on video, and they had intended to use the filmizing process to make video look more like film, and they set up their lighting and their cameras and so on to record for filmizing, to get something that would look film-like after that video process was done. I believe that type of process is done on the new Doctor Who, so you can see it there. Well, that filmizing problem never happened. And because of that, the lighting and some of the sets, some things like this, didn't turn out exactly how they wanted it to. And some people find it looks a little garish. It doesn't have quite the sense of depth to it that you would get from a filmized recording. I felt that on the whole, it looked reasonably good.
Yeah, I thought it looked great, and I wasn't aware of any problems until I read about them on Wikipedia and heard them being discussed on the commentary. I thought it looked fine throughout, and I was quite happy with the appearance of it. But I think as we've discussed before, I'm slightly less aware of these various filming techniques, and I tend to pick up less on the stuff, the difference between video and film.
Yeah, it does look good. I think where you see some of these weaknesses is in some of the darker shots in the floating market and in some of the in-between places and things where they're in these low-light conditions. The balance of light and dark is a little bit odd, and it makes it look more like a studio than a real place. That's sort of a bit of a weakness there. But really, all things considering, I think it looks pretty good.
Yeah, I would agree.
So I think that will wrap things up for the first half of our Neverwhere discussion. Next time, we will fill in some more of the story, talk about some more of those details.
We're going to talk a little bit more about this idea of the hero quest and how Neverwhere fits into some of the classic ideas of that, particularly as in some famous examples that we've already mentioned.
And we'll also talk about some more of these bizarre and wonderful characters that are very much a part of Neverwhere.
Plus, if we get the time, we'd like to touch briefly on the Neverwhere books and the comics and the possibility of sequels or a film version. So all stuff we've got to get to next time, Brian.
That sounds exciting. Should be a good episode. In the meantime, you can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com and at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find us there. So thank you for listening. This is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And thank you very much from Eamon in England, and do check back next time.